You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello there, and welcome to episode 2 of the Comedians Comedian Podcast. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm going to be talking to Dan Evans, who is, I think, an unsung hero of the comedy circuit. He's someone that, because he doesn't go up to Edinburgh and he doesn't sort of tout himself around in on Facebook and in email and those kind of marketing ways that a lot of people do, increasingly myself included, he's someone that you might never have heard of, but he is nonetheless a really excellent comedian. He specialises in almost magic bullet jokes of just beautiful little one-liners that really paint a picture in your head. So it's not just wordplay, but they're really... If you haven't seen any of him, I don't know if he has anything on YouTube, but it's worth putting him into Google and finding out when he's gigging. He's normally based, I think, in London and around the southeast, but I'm sure he travels. Make an effort to go and see him. If you like Milton Jones, if you like Gary Delaney, then Dan Evans is someone you should definitely be checking out. So we're going to talk about writing short jokes. We're going to talk about writing for other people. And Dan's perceived lack of people skills. He's frequently saying throughout the chat that... He's frequently saying throughout the interview that he's always kind of going, God, that sounds awful. I must sound like a terrible human being. I must sound really pompous. But I'm sure you will see, as I experience, his enormous personal warmth. I think he's such a lovely bloke. We talk about the comedian's need for approval. And how that's a shared aspect of our joint, or not joint, our separate, but similar, what's the word? What's the origin? There we go. I was thinking of it like superheroes, like our origin stories. It's to do with the need for approval and also the need to fill conversational silence. So maybe if you're a comic and you... identify with that, maybe this will be of particular interest to you. Dan has some fascinating views on the audience and their similarity to a popular insect, so look out for them. And he'll also be talking about how he gets his brain in gear for the act of writing. Also another thing to look out for, his use later in the interview of the phrase, in the end, we're all dead. So when you get, beep your horn if you're driving to a gig, or loudly play some music when you get to that part, in appreciation of this absolute cynicism, which manages to be quite warm-hearted. Other little bit of admin things, just for 30 seconds before we get stuck in. This show was recorded, as was episode 1, at the Top Secret Comedy Club in Covent Garden in London. So thank you very much to Mark Rothman, the owner and runner of that club, for the runner, it was a stupid phrase, the owner and promoter of that club, for letting us be there. It's a really excellent comedy club. So if you're listening to this from the point of view of a comic, get yourself booked there, because it's just underground and exciting, and it feels like a very exciting place to be doing comedy at the moment. And if you're a punter, an audience member, or a human, as we also call them, try and Google them. I think they're the Top Secret Comedy Club at thetopsecretcomedyclub.co.uk. Have a search for that. I'm sure you can Google it up. But that's a really exciting comedy club. So thanks, Mark, for letting us record in there. The next few chats, probably the rest of this series, aren't going to be recorded in front of an audience like this one is. It's a bit of a faff trying to put together a club, trying to get an audience in to see a podcast, and I'm not much of a promoter. However, these skills are set to be tested at the Edinburgh Festival, as I'm very excited to announce that the Comedians Comedian Live is going to be happening at the Gilded Balloon all throughout Edinburgh on Fridays, Saturdays and Sundays at 12:30. So it's a lunchtime show, and confirmed guests, about which I'm incredibly excited, already include Abandoman, Rod Gilbert. Pappies are going to come along and talk to me about sweating and playing the guitar, no doubt. Josh Widdicombe says he's going to come along. That's great. Who else have I spoken to? I'm sure there's someone else I'm really excited about. Terry Alderton is going to come along. So I'm sure you can already buy tickets for that now. Or if you can't, you will be able to soon at www.edfringe.com. So very excited about that. So by the time we get to Edinburgh, I will be really up and running in a live kind of way. But the next few episodes are going to be sort of pre-recorded, and I'm going to be chatting to the comics that I speak to where they write, where they do their writing. We have a new website, as you'll have heard at the beginning of this, is www.comedianscomedian.com. And also you can tweet me at ComComPod, ComComPod. So please tweet me at ComComPod if you're a comic and you're enjoying this and you have an enormous fan base. Please big it up to the world. I'm very excited to find out from Google Analytics that the show has been downloaded as far afield as Singapore and America, as well as the UK. And there was somewhere else, a couple of people in Switzerland as well. So if one of you is Chris Hemmons, hello. So do shout it from the rooftops, please. I'm increasingly realising that I'm going to have to market this properly in order that people get to hear it. So please do that. All help gratefully received. And please email me at info@stuartgoldsmith.co.uk if you have any questions or suggestions for people about whom you would like me to speak. To whom you would like me to speak. Thanks very much. Here's the show. That's enough guff from me. I hope you enjoy it. This is Dan Evans. Ladies and gentlemen, or more specifically, lady, please welcome to the Comedians Comedian Podcast, Mr. Dan Evans.
Thank you very much.
You're more than welcome. What we'll do there is we'll dub on some applause.
And then we'll
freely admit to the audience, as I'm doing now,
yeah,
there is no one here. There is Tom, the sound man's lovely wife, Sarah. She's knitting. It's pretty awesome.
If we really get going, she'll stop knitting if it gets any sort of quality.
Keep an eye on Sarah. If the needles stop moving, then we're off. So I think of you as a one-liner guy. Now, you do have longer jokes than one-liners, but you are one of the few people, I think, who can effectively tell a joke, like a very short joke, who can effectively write and tell a very short, punchy joke.
Yes, and I suppose that's what I am, and it's probably mainly because I have come from a... You're very comfortable on stage, on the street, talking to strangers, everything.
Yes.
It's one of your things, and
yes,
it feels like that's really what you are,
mm-hmm,
whereas I'm terrified if I go more than 30 seconds without some sort of response. Even after all these years, I think I may be dying.
When you say all these years, how long have you been going?
It's difficult because people fudge their start date, don't they?
From their
first ever gig to when they first started taking it seriously to when they first got paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say that, you know, if I said 15 years, which sounds awful, it makes me feel sick when I say it.
Does it really?
Yes,
you don't
it does.
Feel proud that you've been... You're 15 years good at it, surely?
I'd say I'm probably 7 years good at it.
Okay.
I know.
Okay.
It's just that thing where you, what else could you do? After a few years doing it, you think, well, I've bailed out of what I did.
Yeah.
All that's open to me now is working in Waterstones or something, or, you know, or a minimum wage job.
Yeah.
I'm out of the loop now. So
you've got people skills. No, I've got people skills.
You've got people skills.
Yeah,
I've got the opposite of people, yes.
Object skills.
I can make a whole lot of people feel uncomfortable.
But okay, so you've been doing it between 7 and 15 years.
I'd say 15 plus, but okay, it's a fudgy start time thing.
Sure. And in that time, you said you've been doing this for so long. I've forgotten what you just said to me. I'm sorry. I've just noticed this is incredibly boomy. Is that?
It's become boomy.
It's changed.
Are you getting angrier?
I am. Oh dear. That sounds fine over... I mean, I can't hear it anymore. As long as you're all right with it, that's fine. It was starting to sound weird. What was the point you were making before? You'd done it for 15 years.
I was saying about that I veered towards one... I mean, they're the things that make me laugh anyway.
Yes.
But it's about fear of not having constant approval. Which is why I also really admire acts that don't... that do stories and stuff like that, because they're showing such a commitment to it, you know.
But do you not think that you're... I mean, I think a lot of acts that do stories are thinking, God, I wish I could write short jokes.
Oh, yeah, I think part of this job is being permanently dissatisfied and always thinking, I'm... The way I do it is the wrong way.
Yeah.
You know.
It's really easy to think that, isn't it? Because when you've got no overarching, you've got no boss, you've got to make your own goals, you've got to make your own plans, you've got to be your own boss, you've got to run this whole infrastructure. I always think that about comedy, particularly when people say, "Oh, I've been promoted."
Yeah,
well, you know, friends of mine who with real jobs have been promoted, or they've got a different office, or they've moved on somehow, and you think, "Oh God, yeah." I remember last year I kind of notionally promoted myself to being creative director, so that I felt like, oh yeah, I'm kind of.
Well, I suppose our equivalent is you move up a notch in terms of people wanting you, don't you? Or
yes,
or you do TV, Stu, like you did earlier this year, of course.
Yeah,
and I have to say, you came out of it very well.
Thank you very much. That's
out of the process.
That sentence is exactly what I've heard from everyone. I came out of it, which does at least prove that I came out of it, and I did so well. So I think I acquitted myself.
I think it's probably that you're just not the sort of person to say something a bit cocky that they can use then, probably out of context, to make that the kind of big thing of the week.
I think that is the case. Yeah. But we'll continue this bit of the chat later.
Okay.
So in terms of your output, how did you start? Let's go back to the beginning. How did you start doing comedy? You said you sort of fudged the start date. But what was it that attracted it to you? Were you a funny guy? Are you funny in the pub? Are you funny with your friends? Or did you decide to yourself...
It's funny because when you look back on it, you think, I kind of remember holding court in the pub and things like that. But then I also... Whenever I'm in a pub with people and there's somebody just cracking wise, nothing grates more. And at my age, it's funny,
exactly,
isn't it?
You go,
and I think to myself, that wasn't me, was it? Because there's nothing worse in the world than somebody who doesn't actually listen to what you're saying and is waiting for you to finish so that they can then say something else. I'm sure I wasn't like that. And like the old man I am, I think that's actually in the ascendant now. People on transmit a lot more than receive. But so... I think I was funny in that
context.
But
you don't remember being gratingly funny in the pub. You think that you were funny in the
pub.
No, I pray
I
wasn't. Kind of debonair, rapier-like.
I'll tell you what it was. It's probably all through kind of insecurity and all that, but I always felt responsible for silence in a small group of people in a pub. As soon as silence happened, I would think, it's my job to fill this silence, which probably comes from a lack of confidence or something. Other people would just go, well...
I think that is genuinely a quite beautiful and poetic way of putting it. I feel exactly the same thing. It's like, things could be awkward now, and I need to...
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting that that's a starting point, I think, for both of us, and yet we do wildly different types of things.
Yeah.
Like that, I would think of that as being something that motivates my... Like, I think I'm pretty good at small talk, and I think that was one of my origins, which is why now I can talk to an audience and I can chat and I'm personable and I can stop people in the street and make them listen and turn them into an audience because I can do small talk. And I believe the root of that is worrying about... silence. And yet similarly, you've come out of, you know, you've gone through your sort of comedy experience to this point growing an ability to zap with, you know, to write jokes and like the little bombs.
I mean, the funny thing in a way is, were I in that situation now, I would, at the age I am now, I couldn't care less about that. If there's a silence in conversation, I just think, well, it's not my fault. If these people can't be bothered to put the effort in this conversation. So I wouldn't come from that route now at all where I'd start now. But I think that's the sort of... The original route was just to fill silence, not with jokes, but just with kind of just trying to make sure people got along and stuff, you know.
The impulse to speak.
Like me as well is a kind of big thing.
That's definitely true of a lot of comedians. I don't know if I can think of many comedians who don't seem to care whether or not you like them.
Yes, or if they do, it's an artifice anyway, isn't it? And they're just trying to push some cool button because they think that's... the flavour of the month.
Yeah. So what were your first experiences like of specifically of writing and performing jokes?
Well, it's when I started. Well, I started because two friends a year before I started did one of the original kind of stand-up courses.
Mm-hmm.
I won't say the comedian who ran it. One of them's still doing it, the other isn't. But and I did that with a friend, and we did a 6-week course in that. And just the fact that you had to stand in front of people for 2 minutes each week, just, you know, you have no choice but to just start scurrying stuff down and hoping some of it makes sense, you know.
And was that in joke form at the time? Were you trying to write? Do you remember the sorts of jokes you were writing, or were there observations on things? Or
I think you often start off with... It wasn't really observations because I don't notice things as a rule. I am... Without going into any detail, my upbringing makes me, I am an outsider in my mind.
Okay. That's, would you mind going into detail on that? Because that sounds very interesting.
It's tricky just to say that I had an odd childhood.
Okay.
With reasonably traumatic without writing a book about it.
Sure, so, okay. But sub-misery lit.
Yes, not even, unusual, not good enough, childhood. Not miserable enough to be misery lit. It didn't even have that asset to it. So though in a way that people look at you and think of you as incredibly straight, in inverted commas, and you aren't for reasons we won't go into now, but likewise, people would often brand me with some kind of lazier people, kind of toff thing, perhaps, a Cockney act. In the early days, might be backstage with me and go, "Oh, it's little Lord Fauntleroy," which is kind of absurd.
Wow!
But it isn't what I am. But the fact that I have that kind of outsider thing means I was never going to come from the root of, "Oh, your wife isn't allowed in the loft," or "We all have drawers full of things."
It took me a minute to realise what you meant there. That being a traditional root of your wife not being allowed in the loft. to me, that's not necessarily something I would recognise.
No, that sort of thing where you kind of go, or it feels hollow when you say it. In the same way it feels hollow if I'm ever comparing somewhere, I'd never go on stage and say, "All the ladies in the house make some noise," because as it came out of my mouth, it would just feel... Yes. No, it just feels totally artificial. So I suppose I was just scurrying down anything that I thought was entertaining, and a lot of it was wordplay in the first instant. Because in a way, I've been doing it for longer than you, but it would still probably apply to you that when we started, it wasn't the everywhere thing it is now.
No.
So my knowledge of it would have been from Friday Night Live, The Comedians or something, which was just so not where I was anyway.
Sure.
There wasn't any direct stand-up. We didn't know about cool American acts, because back in my day, that would have meant somebody having a record.
Yes.
So it would have been sort of Python records or things like that. So there wasn't a stand-up core that I could look at and go, that's interesting, I'll do that.
Yeah, I think for me the earliest piece of stand-up I remember seeing was Lenny Henry's Live and Unleashed album, which I had on cassette.
Yes,
it was a 1989 tour, and I remember listening to it back to back on like a school trip.
But exactly, there was no kind of, and there was no idea of how you'd get into it now. In terms of just, the first time I ever saw it would have been at first year at college, and John Hegley, the Popticians, played, and we just went along. We just thought, that's great, but none of the group I was in thought, "Oh, I wonder how you might do that." It just wasn't on the radar.
This is one of the things that it's kind of a thing I keep coming back to, which is that I have trained in all sorts of performance things, but I've been to college and I've done courses and all sorts of stuff, but I've done absolutely no training in stand up. And stand up seems to me to be something that you invent yourself. And the only people that do it are people who saw someone doing it. It's much like street performing. They saw someone do it and they went, "I could do that." And then they just sort of went out and threw themselves at it.
Yeah.
And in some way, which I think is different now, there may be a trend now to think that there is a way that you do it. There's a way that you learn it. There's a way you have your hair, and there's certain trousers that you wear.
A friend, actually, it was George, was saying that he bumped into a new act in Brighton who asked him if he'd done this particular course, which obviously he hadn't. Mm-hmm. And... because he said, "I recognise your rant, and it was in the right position."
Oh my god!
So the idea is that you do 2/3 of your show in whatever it is, and then you have your rant. But the idea that it could ever be that mechanical is obviously absurd. I mean, then maybe the courses have a benefit in as much as you have a deadline, and you will look an idiot if you haven't done something.
Yes,
and you have to stand in front of people. It has to become more than just But beyond that,
and did you, so that's not a very good question, is it? Do you think on Jonathan Ross and so forth, they edit out the bits where he goes, maybe they do, maybe they're not. But were you inspired by particular people? Like after you'd started, were you gigging? Were you like an open spot in rooms headliners, you just went, they've got it?
It's funny because back in that day, and just before I started, when I started going to like the Crouch Air, the King's Head and the Red Rose and the Banana were the three we used to go to. And there weren't that many acts around that often you'd have an act come on stage and you'd feel the whole audience go either, "Oh, it's this guy, I've seen him before," or either kind of, 20 minutes of this. Not an answer, but they just think, "Oh, you'll get through this."
Oh, we know what this
but
is, yeah.
But when I started doing open spots, you always do the CAF, Comedy CAF, and it was the stage where Tim Vine was just coming into the ascendant with what he was doing, so he was winning the competition every week.
Okay.
So, of course, that veered me strongly towards
this
wordplay.
This was the Comedy CAF Wednesday night, new act night, where the winner then comes back the following week.
Yes.
Yes.
And that was, I really remember him from those days, and also an actor I just think so underrated and is just so great, Noel James.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Who's just like one of the most underrated actors. Yeah. He's almost... I mean, he's the ultimate comedian's comedian, but he's just so good at, you know, just jokes, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I was very inspired when I saw him as well for the first time.
And did you, I mean, that's interesting. I was inspired by people who I have grown up to be nothing like. Like, I always remember my big inspiration was Simon Munnery. I used to love Simon Munnery when I went to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, I'm going to start writing jokes and I'm going to end up like Simon Munnery.
Look at you.
Oh, my God. But I thought that's where I would go. But so your idols were, people who inspired you were doing the sort of thing that you now specialise in. You kind of went, that's it, it's short jokes. Is that because
I suppose maybe, again, it was because when I saw somebody like Bill Bailey, who was doing the circuit at the time, who was just fantastic, but I just couldn't ever see myself in that, doing what he was doing, you know, a bit of music and just sort of having the balls to go away from the boom tish bit and just go into this odd stream of whatever. I just thought, I suppose I clung onto lines thinking, oh, I know what they are, I could do those, you know. After a few years, you think, well, if I change what I do now fundamentally, I've got to write the whole lot again. How's that going to happen?
I do love the way that comedy is always, it's always constrained within incredibly bottom line kind of parameters.
Well, you know, like,
at the end of the day, I've got the act. It's written. I may as well do the act. So let's talk about writing then. Do you find that you write in a similar format each time? Does it all do you have a methodology of writing?
No, and it's funny because I remember hearing a thing about, it's a bit like there's a thing, I remember an interview with Richard Curtis that was a really nice, he basically talked about when he writes, what he does, he just prevaricates all day until it gets to around about four or half four, and then the weight of it behind him is just so immense that he just has to start. There's no joyous, oh, I could do some writing. It's just eventually just becomes crushing. And
I think Douglas Adams did the same thing.
Just sort of putting it off and then going, I suppose in a way, when you've been doing it for a while, you kind of, I mean, the thing I always do is have a notebook or my phone with a notepad there. Or anything that even strikes me as remotely amusing in any format, I will put down. And then what seems to get me writing is deadlines. I compare three places a month regularly for a compare a promoter who really trusts me.
Okay.
And so basically I often pull the ideas together that day or in the car, not to my credit, but because I've become comfortable with the audiences there, touch wood, the lazy way, it's starting to come together sometimes on stage, which is...
That's interesting that you would refer to that as a lazy way. Might that not just be that process is really organic? One of the things I was talking to Rob Deering about was the idea of crisis, the panic of having some people there that you have to impress, giving you an extra, just giving you that leg up that gets you over the wall and into funny.
Well, there's another thing where there's that, and then sometimes if you're really lucky, and it can happen if you're talking with somebody just riffing and you just really feel comfortable with them, but you're really comfortable on stage, sometimes something falls out of your mouth and there's been no conscious knowledge of it. I remember doing this little tiny gig in a pub a year and a half ago, and I talked to this guy what he did, and he worked for a toy factory. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about it, and I said, oh, who's it? And it was the people who made an Action Man. And I said, oh, I had an Action Man. And the guy next to him just went, no, you didn't. You had a dolly. And I just, without thinking, I said, all right, it was a Cindy, but my mother scraped the tits off with a hot knife. And he got a big laugh. but it just came out of my mouth, and I didn't. There was no process.
Yes,
and I even did the one I do about the inflatable hammer toy from the fair.
Yes, I do.
I improvised
would you,
that.
Would you mind just telling us, for the sake of the listener? It's a lovely joke.
It's a joke. I don't try and do that much sort of sexual stuff, but when I do, it's supposed to be from an odd angle. Mm-hmm. And when it does, when an audience don't pick up on that and just go, "You're a freak," which has happened a couple of times, you kind of feel like going, just putting the brakes on and going, the kind of joke is that it's from an odd angle, you fool.
Yes.
It's not, but you can't do that because it shows they might have got under your skin. But, and it's just saying about sexual fantasy, going down the fair, winning one of those enormous inflatable novelty hammers, rushing home, stripping naked, unpopping the stopper and squeezing it over your body because you know it's the breath of a real gypsy.
Yeah.
But I improvised that in a club I didn't even like.
Oh, my God.
But it just fell out of my mouth.
Improvised from nothing?
Yes,
from...
I know. I guess the seeds were there, and they had been bouncing
around
a bit.
You'd been at a fair, you'd seen a hammer.
Yes. No, the, you know what I mean? There must, the seeds must have been there, and it must have coalesced. I must have been thinking, how can I? I had a weirder joke that preceded it. I won't go to the Victorian Engineer one. And I guess it was an extension of that. So it was already having, it already had a sort of an open end that needed closing, that joke. So it kind of just stumbled out like that.
Do you find, in terms of like quality control, do you find these jokes that have just come to you out of nowhere, are you more fond of them than jokes that you've scraped away at? Because presumably, I mean, presumably there's another type of joke where, which is a joke where you've written and written and written.
Yes. I don't, I'm just so glad of any joke that works, because the thing people don't remember is if you're kind of Mr. Man of the People who just chit-chats and everybody loves you, you've got 5 minutes with everything. Every idea you come up with is 5 minutes, isn't it?
Yeah,
whereas if you just do jokes, you can be left with 20 seconds, you know, and so for the effort, it's just not really fair.
Yeah.
It's like the curse of not being able to be...
I have something like 4 or 5 one-liners, and I love them so much, and I just... I just love my job because they're my only proper jokes, and those are the jokes that make me feel like a proper comedian, albeit one who's written one good joke a year for his career.
A thing I have found fascinating recently, and it's funny coming into Christmas party season because I noticed it last night, is I like jokes where a picture is in the... You paint a picture in the mind.
Yes.
Somebody sees something in the mind because you say the words. But then the drunker the audience, or the less comedy grammar literate the audience are, in other words, the less frequently they come or the less corralled they are by a decent environment, the less they can paint those pictures. So if you get the end of an evening and you're going blah 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 blah, and basically they're supposed to conjure up this
you've
picture,
you've got to imagine the thing happening in order to realise
do that anymore. Do the ladies in the house thing again, we like that because we could shout. And you know, there's one joke I've got. Do you know the joke, a joke about a neighbour having a chihuahua? I was short of money. Neighbour has a chihuahua running around the garden. I had an idea, I hopped over then, so I borrowed it. I entered it into a race at the Greyhound Stadium, not far from where I lived, and much to everybody's surprise, it won, crossing the line first between the jaws of the dog that came second. And I think that, you know, the reason why that tends to work, I think, is because way back, the film, what was the film called? Fish Called Wanda.
Okay.
Had a scene in it where a Doberman stole a little dog and ran off down the street within its mouth. And I think that has helped that joke 10%, because enough people have that somewhere in the back
of their
brain.
The picture is already there.
They can picture
a
dog with a small dog.
Like.
Yes. So I think it's aided by that tiny...
That's incredible. Remember really?
That? Yes, I do. I think that.
Wow.
I think that's true. I think that's helpful.
Yeah, it might well be, because I agree with you about painting mental pictures. Like, one of my one-liners is a pun. It's the pun about my granny, who's called Vera. That's not her name, but we call her that because she can't walk in a straight line. And it's an unusual pun, but it's a satisfying
a pitching one.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, that's so do you find that the jokes you've slaved over and the jokes that just came out, that just fell out of your mouth, do you afford any time to thinking, how can I make more jokes fall out of my mouth? Do you mean, how can I put myself in a state where that happens? Or do you think, well,
I got
lucky there, but actually it's back to the, you know, back to the grindstone.
Well, the sad thing is, I've realised fairly recently that I think there are some really basic things that make that the case. The first one, and it sounds so ridiculously obvious, but I drink too much.
Okay.
I just do. And if I've drunk the night before a bottle of wine plus, I just don't spark. Of course I don't.
Okay.
Why would I, you know?
Yeah.
If I have a big meal with lots of bread and cheese in it, well, all your blood goes from your brain to your stomach to work the muscles and stuff. All these things are just so fundamental, people don't even think about them, or they would mock them.
Yeah.
You know, but... And also, get somewhere where you can put your phone out of view, so then you don't see the phone and constantly fiddle with it and check your emails and stuff. All these things, which people don't... And just try and get in the zone
you're
of what you're
doing.
You're talking
about in the writing...
Yeah, the writing thing itself.
Rather than performing.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yes, things like that, just get your brain in the right gear, you know.
So what does a typical week's writing look like for you? For how long do you write? When in the day do you do it?
Well, in a way, I'm not as lazy as I come across. I kind of do about a day and a half writing topical jokes for someone, which involves...
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Involves me having a deadline, and I also, because when you get the job, first of all, you try very hard, you then set a bit of a stupid precedent which you can only gradually reduce. you know, you obviously, you do well over time with the first few weeks, you think I really must make a good impression, then you go, oh god. And it's funny because I do a day where I'll look through papers and I'll just, as soon as I know what the idea of the joke is, I'll move on and write the next idea, and I'll have a day where I've written only the roughest, quickest typing way of, like, sort of, so I don't know, sort of Libya, they're always firing guns in there, Tripoli hot air ballooning club must be in trouble, and, you know, and rather than go, oh, let me spend quarter of an hour crunching it exactly now, because I've worked out that that's a gear change, and if you do everything in kind of, oh, the idea's coming, I'll just type it down, and then the next day you spend half that time, like 4 or 5 hours, just really thinking, oh, is that the briefest way? Is that the right person narrating it? Did it happen to him or me or an observed person? And you just play with it with a word processor again and again and again, maybe 10 times.
Okay.
And then it goes, and it's, oh, that's right, yes. And then you move on. Then you do a final revision. But I'm very into the idea of just channeling it.
Sure.
You know.
And that is genuinely fascinating. But that's having, not something that would ever occur to me.
But going, all right, I have a flat hour during the day, and so if I start feeling flat about it, it's not a big deal, I'll just keep trying at it, and then, you know, and then I have another coffee now, and... And sometimes they'll be fully written when they come out first, or either they'll be just...
Okay, so, well, you know. going back to the day with the papers, do you get certain papers? Do you get all the papers? Do you skim them? Do you just read the first 10 pages of each?
This is what the job is. It's sort of, it's the more red top end of things.
Okay.
So there's no point wasting time on things that matter.
Okay.
But I still wonder, I don't know whether the country is obsessed with X Factor and things that drive me absolutely, they don't drive me anything because they're just nothing. They're nothing to me, they're nothing, they shouldn't be anything to anybody.
And yet
I think the papers use them because ITV send them 2 pages that they can copy and paste into the newspaper, so they'll use that because it's not news, it's just easy, isn't it?
Sure.
So that's why they do it. But I'd like to think that whenever in a live context, when everybody mentions the X Factor, there's no appetite for it in an audience, which I really like.
Yes.
Hopefully that's, maybe I'm just playing nicer clubs than I used to, but
yes,
in the early days of Big Brother, people go on and go, who do you like in Big Brother? Everybody go, Tony. Oh, I don't like Tony. And you kind of think, well, this is...
And we'll never get to know exactly what this is, because the technology broke down at that point and we stopped recording, only for a couple of seconds. So I'm going to play that rather lovely jazzy sting again and link us back into where we picked up. You should be able to work out what's going on. But as I say, I can't honestly remember because we stopped recording. Hope you're enjoying it. Speak to you soon.
A lot of the audience will have no idea what Deliverance is. But they have they've absorbed
but
it from
they
somewhere
get, they
else.
They get the trope. They get and can be applied to anything.
Yes,
yeah.
Can be applied to Amersham at the end of the Metropolitan line.
Yes.
Or anything at all.
You know, a very good example.
And it's kind of, you just think, this is just... Really, there would be some people with the right amount of confidence and facial expressions could grunt in a certain timbre and have a good 20 minutes.
Yes.
That is the level. So in a way, we must almost forget about writing and think it's about...
It's purely about a system of making rhythmical noises.
Yes.
Yeah.
In a way, it's the way you react with an audience, the way you interact with an audience at a level you don't even... Like, if I have dry skin, they might at some subconscious level perceive that as an animal weakness. And I, you know, that sounds ludicrous, but I don't think it is.
Okay.
You speak too quickly when you get to the mic, it looks desperate.
Yes.
They don't trust you subsequently. And they don't even know they're doing this.
It's the first couple of seconds of being on stage.
Yeah.
Or the first second... is such a huge deal.
When you smell them and they smell you, and it is animal is exactly the right word.
It's one of the most fascinating things about this whole business is because it's one of the indefinables, isn't it? Mm. You can read all the books and all the courses you like, but it won't make a blight of difference because that is something that you can. It's weird because you can't. I've found you sometimes stumble across something and you go, actually, I should do that, and you get it in your armor. I think you're different because I genuinely think you're upbeat. You like people.
Mm.
Things are positive. You have a positive air about you.
Sure, I mean, I do. Yes, I like people. I try it. If I see an angry-looking guy, I'll try to make friends with him because I think he probably wants to be friends on some level, but he's covered in anger.
Whereas I often walk into a room like the one you're doing tonight, perhaps, and I might just look and go, these are just ants. They just turn food into shit. And here I am. You know, I'm being employed by them. And we have nothing in common.
Yeah.
That's why I like
doing... But you're still desperate for their love, are you?
I'm desperate...
Or you're desperate for the love you give yourself if you make the ants happy.
That's better. Yeah. And also, I suppose I'm desperate to avoid something worse than heckling, which is just that indifferent lack of connection, which means you're a bloke reading a script for 19 minutes, which is an awful feeling for the maturer comic. It's not about being terrified that they're shouting things at you. No. That at least is interaction. The worst thing is just that indifference of hubbub, and we don't really know what you're on about.
Mm.
So I don't think that bad. It sounds like I'm going to do a Hungerford, and this will be played on the news in a few weeks. That's one of the.
It's always worth.
And then he turned the gun on himself.
we've covered lots and lots of different things there, which I'd like to try and remember and talk about.
Not at all.
Fine.
Well, that's good.
We are fine for time. Yeah. We've got a good 12 to 17 minutes left of this, which is good. So let's go back to the topic of writing, because I think one of our sidetracks being more interesting maybe than what we were talking about. That's fine, it's all good. Let's go back to the topical stuff, because you were saying that one of your pet hates is that lazy topical material. But there's other elements to it. So we're talking about whether or not you read an article and you get several ideas out of it, or one idea.
Totally varies. What I've realised is I don't thrive under pressure. I like the pressure of a deadline which I can meet.
Okay.
I don't like the pressure of something that's implausible.
Sure.
And it's funny because when I've written on various kind of, I won't say rubbish because it's the wrong word, but, you know, various TV shows that, you know, are going to go out once and repeated, and they're just a waste of time. They're just like wallpaper.
Okay.
Then you're in a room writing with other people, and I find I very quickly become preoccupied with, how am I doing compared to them?
Yes.
Are they doing better than
me? I've only done that once. I wrote for a radio show once in a room full of people all writing. I found it impossible to do because of my own ego and fragile ego and kind of sense of...
One thing you're not concentrating on is the job you're there to do, which is to write. So that's why, on my own, I don't mind, and I don't put any pressure on, I must have 10 jokes on this story. I'll just read it without even thinking to try and comment on it first. And then you might find key things in there. Or if there's an idea of sort of the way the strikes thing, an angle. So I might just write down an angle and move on, because I just don't want to slow down the process by trying to hone something that will ultimately be honable. But the process of honing it can be depressing, because it takes a quarter of an hour.
Sure. And it takes you out. I think you're absolutely right about that, rhythms. If you're in the mode of looking for angles, something I do all the time is I sit down and I type away and I end up tweaking grammar of a joke that isn't, I don't even know if it's funny yet. The tweaking spelling and punctuation. So
mustn't be hard on yourself, because sometimes these are little things that we do while our brain is catching up or
going sideways. Well, it's still writing, isn't it? Yeah. Even if you're not doing it, as long as you're sitting down thinking about it, you're still thinking about your job on one level.
So say the sometimes quite broad idea. So if you've got the cabinet, so if you think of the cabinet currently telling dinner ladies that they shouldn't strike because they're having their pension reduced, the idea of an Eton millionaire having that opinion, then there's an angle about how he's done many things for the poor, and you just start thinking about giving him a scholarship boy maybe strapped in front of a fire at Eton, and him picking a marshmallow out of the ashes and giving it to him when the other boys are gone, or something that is an absurd sort of example of you stand up for somebody, but then you undercut it, and you go, no, I think he's great, because, and then you just spoil it,
So you would write down eat marshmallow ? And move on.
Yes,
just to remind yourself.
Now
it's
coming out a little bit faster now.
Okay. What sort of volume are we talking? How many angles do you think you'll come out of a 2-hour session or a 4-hour session?
I tend to do an hour and a half and then have a little wander around, an hour and a half.
A little wander around. You're around your house?
No,
around
Costa. I go to Costa.
Okay.
Which I don't know why.
Okay, but you have a little wander around Costa every so often.
It's the most generic sort of environment ever.
It's pretty generic.
It could be like a, you know. I suppose I would try and produce 50 jokes in a working day.
Okay.
Which, and I wouldn't think any of them were pure shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of them would be inappropriate.
So you
person.
Do, there is an amount of editing whereby you go, that's just, I've got an angle, but actually I can't bear to think about it. It's awful.
Yes, like,
rubbish.
Yes, if it's just a silly, you know,
sure.
Pun about something, you just think, well, the only reason that would work is in ever is because people have it thrown at them quickly and they forget about it. But
sure.
Yeah, so, yes, not absolute rubbish, but some things you think it's not really what this person would go for.
Sure. So you'd zoom through, you'd get 50 down in what? You'd do an hour and a half, have a little wander, another hour and a half? What kind of hours are we talking? Would you work?
I don't know, probably over sort of 6 or 7 hours that might be, mm-hmm. 50 or 60 mm-hmm. little angles on things.
And then the following day, having slept on them, not thought about them again.
Just not drunk that night, made an effort not to drink.
Yeah, no cheese, no bread.
No bread, no cheese. A good night's sleep, and just get up and try and make sure you're not behind before you start by getting up late and all that.
So do you think the imposed discipline of having to write such a volume for someone else, for someone else's consumption, at someone else's command, say, do you think that has got your own generator kind of up and running for your own? Have you noticed that your own in output has increased because of that?
Yes, a little bit. I think because you partly, you get a few offcuts, which you can use, and you think, oh, that would never work for them, I'll have it.
Mm-hmm.
Your brain's more in that mode. You're less precious about jokes. You know, when you start and you have kind of 5 minutes, you think this sort of works,
mm-hmm.
and you hold on to it, and it's, even this time, it's hard to drop something that's working, isn't it? Because you just think, well, what if the new bit doesn't work so well? Yeah. But once you release things and go, I'm not going to be precious about jokes so much, mm-hmm. more kind of come because you don't hold on to the other joke, or you're not thinking, you know, you're just letting things be freer, you know?
Yeah.
And I think writing for other, I think one of the tragedies about the job, you get a job writing for somebody else, you'll be paid for a day and you'll sit there and you'll gladly go nuts for a day.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day it's your day and you get up late and you piss around and do nothing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's just one of those things. But I think in a way part of it's because you can know somebody else's angle better.
So yes.
Like, I wrote for a Joe Caulfield radio show and you kind of know, oh, she's a bit bitchy, but she's not too much. And
sure.
with that angle, you can kind of see where she's coming from and generate quite a lot of stuff.
And in terms of your own angle, do you feel you have an angle, or is that what arrests process?
I've arrived at one. You see, it's a shame because some people have really crisp ones, like they're a bit of a toff or a little bit anal, or they're a little bit this or a little bit that, or a lot of attitude or whatever. But it's sort of, I'm a slightly odd bloke, I suppose, slight outsider.
Mm-hmm.
But you never get as crisp an idea of it as other people, which is probably why it's often easier if somebody says, can you do me a day's writing of jokes?
Do you find then that you're ever questioning your own personality, your persona on stage, or your actual personality? You're going, is that the sort of thing I say? Is that what I think? Does that come into it, or is it just a case of is this idea funny or not?
I think I'm a bit obsessed with the idea of refining persona and deciding to find it more crisply. The thing I would love to get is what clothing to wear.
So I would love to know what clothing to wear.
The reason I wear a suit is I just thought before then I was wearing all manner of what I thought was, it wasn't outlandish, remotely outlandish, but just anything. Like, well, maybe I'll wear the polo neck tonight, sweating like an old man, you know, just dripping with sweat. And then you just go, actually, if I just buy a suit that's quite, it's reasonably charismatic suit, it's a chalk stripe, not a pinstripe, and it's nice cut and things, and it looks quite battered now, then I never have to decide that.
It looks quite battered now.
No, I never have to think about it anymore. I've made that decision. So, but now I'm thinking, is that underselling me? Because if when you go on stage, people know what you're like from the start, that's great, isn't it? You've already done, it's the same as having to throw away your first few lines so that they go, oh, that's what the bloke's like. I suppose write everything down, always have a notebook is my sort of fixation with, because you just lose so many things otherwise, or you think you have. You think, that must have been a gem, and it probably wasn't. Trying to have 2 hours is kind of, an hour and a half, 2 hours, not trying anything less than that, because otherwise, if you do half an hour on something, it takes you half an hour to get into something, doesn't it? So if you're only ever doing the get into it stage, it's really discouraging, because you go, oh, well, I've come up with nothing.
I find it takes me about an hour to get into it. The first hour is always dross, and I sit there all dispirited and unhappy, determined to sit down and keep and get through it.
And I think I cut myself more slack now, where I go, that first bit isn't just nothing. It's you getting in the right frame of mind. So don't go, as soon as you start, it's a bit like sitting in with other people and writing. As soon as you start going, oh, I've been doing 25 minutes and I haven't thought of anything yet, then your mind is on not on thinking of entertaining things or whatever things you're trying to think of. It's on the fact that you're worrying about that you haven't done it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And it's sort of, that's not what you're there for. So you're just not doing it.
I wonder sometimes whether it's a confidence trick that if you, that maybe acts who are prodigious in output are so because they don't spend any time worrying about whether or not they're any good at it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm absolutely sure of that, yeah.
Do you ever find yourself thinking that you might run out? Do you ever feel like it's a finite amount of stuff? Or I suppose with the... You seem to work by kind of... Even in the descriptions of the jokes you were talking about before, you're shifting paradigms. You're going, whose angle? Who's looking at this? Who in whose idea, in whose mind, out of the characters in this joke, is this happening?
You've got to do, I think as an intelligent person, you do that, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one of the things I think about all these sort of...
Me, not so much.
No, but you probably do, but you don't think it fits what you do, so you don't bother pursuing it. But,
okay.
So, like, I hate... One of my pet hates... I've never written anything about it because it's not very me. It also just sounds a bit sort of Jewish New York or something, which isn't me. But it's when I'm in a queuing up for a coffee, which I have an espresso, and someone's ordering this huge elaborate thing with syrups and mousses and stuff, and you kind of think... You don't have the guts to buy a pudding. So you're going, I only had a coffee. But the fact is, when that's happening, the next level of that is being more as objective as possible, which is really how you find peace in your life, isn't it? Is by being as objective as possible and removing all the crap.
Yes.
The reason I'm angry with that person is because I didn't get up early enough and I'm now behind schedule and I'm... There's some reason why I'm angry with someone, some piss-poor reason why I'm cross with someone. It's not about their coffee. Though there will be a routine in that, a lazy routine about... people in coffee shops buying fancy coffees, you know. So, but I haven't got the guts to write it. But the fact that at the end of the day, if that's the coffee they like, what does it matter?
You know, that's a good point.
But then if you over pursue it, you just go, well, in the end, we're all dead.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm holding on to.
I think that can be reductive as well. One of the ways in which I find, one of the things I find very challenging about writing is that I often solve problems in my head rather than letting the problems be there. What is the deal with so-and-so? And you think, well, the deal with that is that you have to do that because of the council, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or something like, hey, traffic wardens, man. Well, if there weren't traffic wardens, then we wouldn't be able to park anywhere. And I find that I solve the problems rather than having an open field on going,
but that's nice,
what is
because
that about?
It feels like you'll never be in a situation where you're so insincere that you're up there saying things that you know are simply just superficial. It's like when people tackle political stuff in stand-up, it's very difficult because they're often saying rabble-rousy things, a little bit Daily Mail probably, but it gets a response because it's easy, and politics and things like that aren't easy, are they?
Do you ever write political jokes? Obviously, as someone that writes topical things, to what extent do they become
only in a kind of... I just think that the world is so in trouble in the way things are structured, that it just isn't possible to convey anything but the most superficial talk about it. There's so many things wrong with the way the world works at that level. And the fact that all these idiots lap it up and just distracted by X Factor and all this fancy phones, of which I fall victim to as well. And that's in a way the amusing thing is that you rail against something, but then you realise...
You're part,
I suppose, because you're a person and you're just part of these patterns of human behaviour.
Yeah.
But it's just, you kind of think... That's so big. I could never sum that up in a kind of joke, you know. So, what's the point, you know? I'd rather just...
ants?
Yes. No.
With your phones?
Well, a little bit like that. But then they're ants because I would behave like an ant as well. It's a bit like if we were in Nazi Germany, we would have not... If somebody gradually increased our responsibility for doing awful things, much as we might like to say we would never do it, we would have done it. If we were Rwandan in the, you know, 90s or whatever, we'd have killed loads of people. Because you just... You're not anything. You're just one of them, aren't you? We're just one of them.
I love it.
So I've taken on a bit of a tangent.
No, not at all. Not at all. I
like to do political stuff. There are people who do, you know, sort of George Carlins and people like that who can do interesting things that make you think more. I'm just not one of those. I would like to be, but I'm not.
Sure.
But yes.
Sure. Do you? We've not got long left.
How long do we have? Do you think?
Like kind of 3 or 4 minutes.
Okay.
If there's any, are there any burning issues you'd like to mention? Anything you'd like to talk about? There's a couple of other things I'd like to hit.
I can't think of anything.
Fine.
No.
Okay. We'll whiz on. Do you ever? We're talking about the writing process. We'll do one last thing on the writing process.
Can I just say that?
Go on.
I need to just say when I say I sit there and it just comes out of me. I was just saying that I find that to be in the gear of coming up with angles and part written jokes. Mm-hmm. why break the flow when you're doing
yes.
it?
No,
I just sit there and it comes out of me kind of amazing creative volcano. I wasn't saying that.
That's totally clear.
Okay.
I think the first show, your first Edinburgh show, should be called Ants with Phones, and the second one can be the creative volcano. But do you watch? Do you watch your? Do you record your stuff? Do
no,
you
I can't listen bear back to it? At myself? Apart from the fact that I've aged, and when I look at an old passport, I think you didn't know, but you were quite an attractive bloke, and I didn't know at the time. Yeah. And now I maybe have
but
more.
Do you
confidence
not think that
now.
You in the future will look back and go, look, you in the now?
Do you know you shouldn't say that because it just makes me think how hideous will I be in the future to have that opinion of what I look like now.
Just like, so, but you and you don't listen to your gigs back. So, you anything you remember to tweet jokes is just purely from memory.
I can't bear it.
Okay.
Also, this sounds wrong, but when I started out, there were two or three acts who did that religiously, and they were all shit. Mm-hmm. I know there are plenty of acts who record themselves all the time and are great, but the three people I'm thinking of, I won't name names, mm-hmm. were very poor, and I thought. It doesn't seem to be a winning tactic. No,
I've mentioned Edinburgh there. Have you? I said your first Edinburgh show. Have you been up to Edinburgh at all?
I've done sort of package shows and things. I've never had the balls to go up there.
Well, this is something we've talked about before because I want you to go to Edinburgh.
But I don't see the point. The fact is, I don't need to do all the jokes that I know work anyway.
Yeah,
I would need to come up with some big angle on the world, which God knows what that is. What do I have to say about it?
Ads with phones.
Well, I know, but it seems rather mean-spirited. You slow down and think
rather
about it.
Rather mean-spirited, Guardian. So you've no opinion of Edinburgh, or your opinion is that it's not for you?
It's got slightly out of hand, and I think, you know, that maybe big acts shouldn't go up there and just strip the audience. I think there's too many people making money. Everybody says all this. Too many people making too much money. And inconveniencing the process, really. Mm. It should be a smaller fringe thing without people at the conference centre and what have you, which seems just like you might as well go and look at the tattoo, really, you know, because they're going to come to your town before long anyway, aren't they?
Sure. So finally, then, to wrap this up, and thank you very much.
The one thing I would say about it is it does make people, they go, oh, God, I've got to get a show together in 6 months.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So that can't be, that's got to be
and it is,
thing.
And it's a month on the heavy bag, isn't it? You know, you're trying in with dwindling numbers and, well, not dwindling, but small numbers.
dwindling would suggest. Round, yes.
but then last, just to wrap things up, what kind of advice would you give to you when you were starting out now? What wasn't as you expected it to be?
Well, it's slightly sadly, I think you probably don't be so open. You have to have a kind of slight veneer when you're going around all these clubs when you're starting out. Mm. The tendency is to always apologise and undermine yourself to people who potentially could not just give you work, but not about money, but it's about the chance to perform again. So I was forever running myself down and apologizing for things, and sometimes you just hold back, they'll actually apologize for the audience or something. Don't without realizing it, use language that says I'm a bit shit, because it implies you're a bit shit, and if people keep saying that,
and that presumably goes for sort of apologizing after a bad gig. I mean, how do you deal with that? How would you recommend a newer act deal with that? If you have a bad gig, you talk to the promoter, or do you run away? What's the best thing to do?
Never, ever do the, you know, we know people, the stupid bullshit thing where, you know, they always tell you that every gig they've done, they've just ripped the room apart and all this sort of stuff. Because it's all, it's ludicrous. You've been working with these people for years on end.
Yeah, of course.
The idea that you can just be some fantasist is just absurd. So
having a long-term vision to begin with and thinking, I'm going to be doing this for a while.
Yes, or either going, I might even just enjoy. That's why I really like something like Adam Bloom, because they just enjoy the process of performing live. They haven't gone, oh, where's my television break?
Yeah.
You know, why am I on television all the time? So, no, I think acknowledge something's gone, go, well, that wasn't so good, was it? You know, but don't talk to them that much. Get out of there. Don't let it get, you know, and actually think about why it didn't work, and maybe it was down to some little tiny nuance at the very beginning that
being
they
honest
buy
with
you.
Yourself about why it didn't work as well. That's a major one. But let's just finish on the note of doing it for the love of doing it.
No, I think that's something. I think you come back to that after a few years. You kind of go, you have a couple of years where you just don't really enjoy it and you resent going out. And then you sort of think, can I just tell you a little slightly heartwarming story? It's about half a minute long.
Do it.
I compare this regular gig in Northampton. It's about 10 times a year. It's a lovely gig as a rule. And there's a bloke there who's always been in the front row, this policeman with his son who's about 17. And he's always come and we chat occasionally. But then he sent me an email in the week because he got my address from out of the somewhere or other. And he was just saying about how he'd come 14 years ago. His wife had two incredibly premature kids that were all in incubators for sort of 24 hours a day. And he was like, continually running around trying to control this situation. and he was really stressed. And a friend recommended, just said, go to this show. And he went along. And actually, Adam Bloom was one of the acts who was on. Mm-hmm. And he just said, it really just gave me 2 or 3 hours out of my troubles. And then he sort of said, he just listed all these acts he's seen over the years and how he you know, enjoyed seeing me every week, every couple of weeks or every month or whatever. And he just said that, you know, you're doing it for the people like that sometimes, just to, you know, give them a good time, take them out of themselves. Mm. So it's quite, it was just really...
That's lovely.
Welling up sort of thing.
It got me right there.
It was, yeah. It was, you know, they're not always drunken idiots, you know. Yeah. They're often just people you're entertaining, aren't they?
Yeah.
So there.
Ants with Souls. The second show. Thank you very much, Dan Evans. You'll notice our audience has quadrupled since we started.
All right.
Thank you very much for watching. Please, for watching and for listening, please give a huge round of applause to the wonderful Dan Evans. Thanks, team. This has been the Comedians Comedian Podcast. I've been Stuart Goldsmith, and blah, 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 blah. I don't know what I'm supposed to say at the end yet. I'll dub it on. What an incredible outro. Yes, that is exactly how it's done. Take note, all other performers in any kind of media. Thank you very much for listening. Here's the clever thing. Here's a thing you can do for me. If you've listened to this on iTunes, you can go onto the iTunes page and you can rate it. And apparently, if you choose to give it the 5 stars, I heartily believe in my heart that is worth. If you give me 5 stars, apparently, if just a few people do that, it can make a real difference. I'll be in with a chance of getting it featured on iTunes, and obviously that means more people hear about it and more people will listen to it, which doesn't mean anything in sort of financial terms, so probably it doesn't mean anything apart from my ego, but that would be great. So rate it if you like, give me some feedback, doesn't have to be good. But the clever thing is, even if you don't like the show, you can still rate it 5 stars. It's entirely up to you. The other thing, I was thinking a little stealth campaign. If you've enjoyed it, it would be really useful if you could just email a friend or two, or if you know any comedians or any people that like comedy. Let's get networky about this, please. And if you've enjoyed it and you know anyone you think would like it, please send it to them as well. I'm sort of finding this easier to market than I do myself as a comic, where you've got to go, hey, check me out. Because I think I'm having interesting conversations here. I think this is the sort of stuff I would be pleased for someone to tell me about. So I have no compunction, no qualms at all about telling you to get it out there. So please do. We're back in 2 weeks with Dan Antopolsky, who is, he's kind of like a wizard when it comes to comedy. He's kind of, what's he like? He's got a linguistics background, and he's going to be talking quite in depth about different ways of wrong-footing an audience throughout the meter of a joke, and what things you can do to wrong-foot an audience and try and... You know what I mean? It's like... No, you don't know what I mean, and I don't know what I mean. You'll have to listen to it. It's a really fascinating conversation with an extremely clever and very funny man. And he's also going to be talking about sketch comedy and his new sketch outfit, Jigsaw. So look out for that in 2 weeks. And remember to tweet me your questions and feedback at comcompod, or email me info@stuartgoldsmith.co.uk. I'm sure by the next time we speak, or I speak to you, that I will have an email address connected to the website, which is www.comedianscomedian.com. I've been pulling out all the stops over the last fortnight and making my friend Toby, who does my web stuff, work very hard. So thanks to Toby. Thanks, of course, to Dan Evans. Thank you to Mark Rothman. Thank you to Pete Dobbing and Asher Trelevin for their creative contribution, and the sound guy on this episode was Tom Wateraker, and also thanks to his delightful wife Sarah, who was our only audience member. The music was by Dan Melrose, and sound mastering and other technical doobries are by my wonderful friend Graham Crockford. Thank you very much for listening. Back in 2 weeks with Dan Antopolsky. I've been Stu Goldsmith. Speak to you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.